May it please the court. The respondent in this case, Steve Lomax, was charged with unlawful possession of a firearm under Section 571.070 for possessing a firearm after previously being convicted of a felony.
Counsel, but as in Robinson, the crime occurred before the constitutional amendment. Is that correct?
Yes. The offense date of Mr. Lomax's crime was June 12, 2014. Under the court's decisions in Merritt and McCoy, it would be the prior version of Article 1, Section 23 that would apply to Mr. Lomax's case. However, as those opinions state and the opinion in Dotson state, the strict scrutiny standard is still what applies in this case. And as this offense occurred before the enactment of Amendment 5, the precedents in Merritt and McCoy are extremely fitting in this case. The situation is the same. The offense, as is the offenses in Merritt and McCoy, was committed before Amendment 5. However, as this court noted in Dotson, after the McDonald opinion, all restrictions on that fundamental right to bear arms would be subject to strict scrutiny. Strict scrutiny requires, again, the state to prove the compelling interest and that that law is narrowly tailored to further that interest. In this case, as in the previous arguments you've heard, the state's compelling interest is the public safety, ensuring the public safety and reducing the firearm violence and the risk of firearm violence to the public. The court has found that in both Merritt and McCoy and the prior version of Article 1, Section 23, that is a compelling interest.
So there are different standards, strict scrutiny for the First Amendment than the Second Amendment?
I believe that the strict scrutiny, it does apply, the court determines how it applies to each right. And it depends on the context of the case. As this court noted in Merritt, that the application of strict scrutiny depends on the context, including the controlling facts, the reasons advanced by the government, relevant differences, and the fundamental right involved. Strict scrutiny has always been applied differently to different rights by the courts.
So if a lobbyist who filed a report late gets a Class D felony, they could come forward and say, I like to hunt, I like to go hunting, and I can't do that now because I can't have a gun. Can you narrowly construe that and say, yes, he can do that?
I think that it doesn't apply to that specific individual. It applies, we're looking at the law as a whole. And the question before this court is whether Section 571.070 is constitutional in that it passes that strict scrutiny test. However, that strict scrutiny test applied to a right to bear arms is not necessarily going to be applied the same as discrimination based on a suspect class or religious liberty or free speech. This court notes that that these are applied differently based on the context, and that that's what's important.
Yet we have held, or at least the jurisprudence has held, that the American Nazis having a demonstration in Skokie, Illinois, where a large number of Holocaust survivors and Jewish people are. They have to let them have their, even though it can cause a riot and people can get hurt, they have to allow them to do that. And the same thing with Jehovah's Witnesses, who have their own position, but they can say whatever they want to say on the street corner, but the people can't stop them, even though it might cause a riot and people could get hurt.
And those strict scrutiny does apply in free speech cases. In this case, with the Second Amendment, with the right to bear arms, or under Article 1, Section 23.
Is it your understanding that overbreath doctrine only applies to the First Amendment cases?
Yes. I don't believe that the overbreath doctrine has ever been held in this state or by the United States Supreme Court to apply to the right to bear arms. And in this case, what the relevant standard is that strict scrutiny standard, which this court has already found this law to pass or to survive that review in both Merritt and McCoy. And this is the same, this case, Mr. Lomax's case, is in the same situation as both Merritt and McCoy, with an offense date that predates Amendment 5. However, even under Amendment 5, that strict scrutiny review is still what applies. The state has to prove the compelling interest and that the law is narrowly tailored. Those are the relevant standards to review under strict scrutiny. And this court has found that that this law survives that review.
I'd note here also that the convictions, that the crime here was stealing and the prior crime here was stealing. and the crimes alleged in this instance are, in addition to possessing a firearm, were possession of a controlled substance and unlawful use of drug paraphernalia?
Yes. Mr. Lomax was charged with the unlawful possession of a firearm along with three counts of possession of a controlled substance, felony possession of a controlled substance, and one count of misdemeanor unlawful use of drug paraphernalia. He had prior convictions for stealing, felony stealing from 2012, but he also had additional prior convictions for possession of a controlled substance, for distribution of a controlled substance near a school, and a prior conviction for a felon in possession of a firearm. So in this case, unlike Mr. Robinson and Mr. Clay, whose priors were for the unlawful use of a weapon, carrying a concealed weapon, Mr. Lomax has the prior for stealing, but he also has additional priors as well.
Thank you.
And however, it is not the nature of the defendant's prior that is relevant to this determination. As this court noted in Dotson, the fact that the violent felons are named in Amendment 5 doesn't increase the rights of nonviolent felons. The rights of nonviolent felons can still be restricted under the strict scrutiny test. The government has the compelling interest in reducing the firearms crime, and then the law is narrowly tailored in that the court has found that someone with a felony conviction is more likely to engage in that violent and illegal gun use that puts other citizens at risk. And that narrow tailoring does not require the exhaustion of every conceivable alternative to the existing law, just that law is narrowly tailored. And this court noted in Merritt and McCoy that even a law that's only exception was the possession of an antique firearm would still pass strict scrutiny. And in this case, as in Merritt and McCoy, he has to have had a conviction, not a suspended imposition of sentence. It doesn't apply if his conviction had been expunged or pardoned. And those are all ways in which this is narrowly tailored. It doesn't apply to someone with a misdemeanor conviction, only a felony conviction. And that it is those people with the felony convictions that pose the increased risk.
Are the only two states that have actually considered this been Missouri and Louisiana? I assume it's a uniform law that someone drafted that for protection of the right to bear arms across the country. Are those the only two states that considered this kind of amendment?
I believe Missouri and Louisiana are currently the only two states whose right to bear arms specifically mentions the strict scrutiny standard. Other courts have applied the strict scrutiny standard in the wake of Heller and McDonald, where the Supreme Court declined to specifically delineate a standard of review. Courts have found different interpretations. Some federal courts have done an intermediate or means end scrutiny, but other courts have applied a strict scrutiny review. But there are no other states that have mentioned strict scrutiny.
Which states have have applied strict scrutiny? Which other states have applied strict scrutiny?
I know both the Tenth Circuit applied a strict scrutiny review and found that a law was survived strict scrutiny in United States versus Marzella. And though I'm not sure if the New Hampshire court applied a full strict scrutiny review, they did note that one of their laws restricting the right to bear arms was narrowly tailored. And those decisions, I think, were noted by the court in the Merritt and McCoy decisions. So there hasn't been a federal standard of review delineated. Missouri and Louisiana have decided to protect that strict scrutiny standard by placing it in the Constitution. And any restriction that will be passed on those laws on the right to bear, any restriction of the right to bear arms will be subject to that review in Missouri. The felon in possession law here has already been found to survive that review. Merritt and McCoy are the applicable precedents that apply in this case and should control the court's decision. Thank you. May it please the court.
Sure.
Missouri's felon in possession law is unconstitutional because the amendment to Article 1, Section 23 separated convicted violent felons from other citizens. Mr. Lomax is not a convicted violent felon. And after the amendment, this law does not pass strict scrutiny.
In August of last year, the people of Missouri voted to amend the state's constitution. Specifically, they voted to make the right to bear arms unalienable. In doing so, the text of the Missouri Constitution now states that any restriction on the right to bear arms shall be subject to strict scrutiny, but nothing in this section shall be construed to prevent the General Assembly from enacting general laws which limit the rights of convicted violent felons. When reading the text of a constitutional provision, courts give words their plain meaning. The provision has now specifically separated convicted violent felons from other persons. The felon in possession law only applies to the convicted felons. Thus, when analyzing this statute, there are two categories of people to which it applies: convicted violent felons and convicted nonviolent felons. In Merritt versus State and State versus McCoy, this court also looked to whether the same statute, Missouri's felon in possession statute, was constitutional. However, in those cases, this court found that the amended version of Article 1, Section 23 did not apply. In applying Article 1, Section 23 as it stood prior to the amendment, this court found that strict scrutiny would have applied based on the fact that the United States Supreme Court, McDonald versus City of Chicago, found that the right to bear arms is a fundamental right. This court found that under pre-amendment strict scrutiny analysis, the felon in possession statute passed strict scrutiny. However, prior to the amendment, there was no requirement that convicted violent felons be analyzed separately from other citizens. Therefore,
and are we under the amendment, or wasn't the crime in this case prior to the amendment?
Your Honor, the crime in this case was prior to the amendment. The state in its brief did not raise that this does not apply under the amendment.
But McCoy and Merritt do say that you look at the time of the crime, don't they? Those are our latest cases on this issue.
Yes, Your Honor. At the time that this court ruled on Merritt and McCoy, this court was looking to determine whether the felon in possession law passed strict scrutiny as applied to all convicted felons, which is a group that includes violent felons as well as nonviolent felons. Because the group that was being analyzed includes violent felons, it was much easier for the statute to pass strict scrutiny at that time. Since the amendment, courts analyzing restrictions on the right to bear arms must first ask whether the person is a convicted violent felon and then apply strict scrutiny to that group. Mr. Lomax is not a convicted violent felon. He has no previous convictions for anything that requires any element of violence. Because
how do we know whether his stealing conviction involved violence or not?
Your Honor, the requirements for a conviction of stealing don't require any sort of force or any sort of violence.
But how do we know he didn't use force? I mean, your prior counsel suggests that we have to consider that too, consider the facts of the case. Or do you differ with his opinion in that regard?
Your Honor, there is no evidence before this court that there was any element of violence in that stealing conviction.
Are you suggesting that in every case that there's a little mini trial to determine what the prior conviction consisted of and whether or not it consisted of violence, whether or not the elements of each crime did involve violence?
Your Honor, I'm suggesting that this time there will be certainly felonies where there's an element of violence required. In those cases, the state can merely propose that they were convicted of those crimes. If the state wants to prove that they are a violent offender, they need to put forth elements of a crime showing that...
Well, elements of the crimes or real facts of the underlying crime. That's what I'm trying to figure out. I just want to know what your argument is.
Yes, Your Honor. Unless it is specifically an element of the crime, the state would then have to put forth the facts of the case in order to show.
Do you agree with your opposing counsel that the overbreath doctrine only applies in the First Amendment context? Because it appears what you're suggesting is really that sort of analysis.
Your Honor, the overbreath doctrine has not been used other than in First Amendment analysis, but I don't think that means that it cannot be used in a Second Amendment analysis. This is also an unalienable right, as is the right to free speech. An overbreath analysis could be proper here, but it also doesn't pass strict scrutiny, which is what is required in this case. In order to pass strict scrutiny, the statute must be necessary to achieve a compelling government interest and narrowly tailored to accomplish that purpose. The burden is on the state to prove that the statute passes strict scrutiny. The stated government interest in this case is to prevent the future crime and in protecting the public. However, it's not enough to have a compelling government interest. The statute analyzed must be narrowly tailored to achieve that interest. The state claims that the felon in possession statute is narrowly tailored in that it is limited only to convicted felons. However, many of the distinctions between persons who are convicted felons and those that are not are arbitrary. Therefore, a statute that draws these distinctions, such as the felon in possession statute requires us to do, is not narrowly tailored to promote the government's interest in public safety. The state first says that a person who receives a suspended imposition of sentence is not a convicted felon, and therefore, those persons aren't banned from possessing firearms under our felon in possession statute. However, the distinction between persons who receive a suspended imposition sentence and those who receive other punishments for similar crimes are frequently arbitrary. The punishments that person receives after being found guilty are largely based on who the judge is at sentencing, or the prosecutor on the case, or whether that person decided to plead guilty or go to trial. Furthermore, persons who receive suspended impositions of sentence may later violate that probation, and thus their suspended impositions of sentence are frequently revoked based on things such as not paying fees for probation. These are not related to the government's interest in public safety, and thus are arbitrary and not narrowly tailored to achieve that purpose. The state also cites that persons who are convicted of misdemeanors are not prevented from bearing firearms under the felon in possession statute. But again, the distinctions between felonies and misdemeanors are often arbitrary. For example, a person who has two misdemeanor convictions for stealing under $500 and again steals under $500 within 10 years is charged with a felony. However, a person with two misdemeanor stealing convictions for stealing under $500 who waits the 11th year and again steals under $500 is charged with a misdemeanor. The difference between a person who steals under $500 three times in 10 years and a person who steals under $500 three times in 11 years is arbitrary.
Well, all lines in that sense are arbitrary, but the legislature has to draw them at some point, don't they? In many contexts.
Yes, Your Honor, it's true that lines do need to be drawn somewhere. But these are distinctions that require a person to either face a lifetime ban on their right to bear arms, which the citizens of Missouri have found to be unalienable, versus being allowed to carry a firearm the day after they plead guilty in court. And thus, it's not narrowly tailored to achieve.
Well, when we talk about narrowly tailoring, do we have to delve into the credibility of the reports that the legislature relies on? Or, in other words, there's this report that they cite that say that there's a higher rate of violent crime committed by anybody who has a prior felony. Are we permitted or obligated to assume that the legislature relied on that sort of information or not?
Your Honor, are you referring to the studies they cited? Your Honor, this court can look at those. However, this court has actually stated in McCoy that the studies states they prove nothing about the law's design, and it's merely an example of why ever-changing body of science and statistics is ill-suited to constitutional analysis.
That gets right back to the question I'd like you to answer. Assuming we're to do the type of analysis you suggest, then do we reevaluate or evaluate whatever statistics either side gives us or whatever statistics either side gave to the legislature when they passed the law?
No, Your Honor.
If they have one study that would support strict scrutiny, then either the state comes up with it or there's one that the legislature relied on specifically, that's good enough, and we're not to look at the credibility of the study or anything else.
No, Your Honor, that's not what I'm trying to say. The studies themselves only create a rational basis for the creation of these statutes.
Well, they do create a rational basis. Why do they only create a rational basis?
Your Honor, they only show correlation. They don't show any causation, and that's not enough when we're looking at narrow tailoring. We need
so what causation are you saying you have to show? I mean, how could you show individual causation when you're dealing with a study?
It's not so much individualized that the study is going to show. It's going to show perhaps certain
correlations.
Sure, certain correlations between previous felonies and future violent gun crime.
And it's the general, if you don't respect the law sufficiently that you commit a felony, there's evidence that indicates a general disrespect for the law and creates more likelihood you'll violate it in the future.
Yes, Your Honor, I think at best that's what the studies will show. But again, that's just not enough when we're looking at strict scrutiny. It doesn't show that these laws are narrowly tailored. It doesn't show a close fit between prohibiting nonviolent convicted felons from having a lifetime ban on bearing firearms, which is their fundamental right. The state has relied on the fact that only convicted felons are included in the felon in possession law to prove that it is narrowly tailored. But these distinctions between convicted felons and those that are not are frequently arbitrary. And the right to bear arms was determined by the citizens of Missouri to be unalienable. A lifetime ban on the possession of firearms cannot be based on arbitrary distinctions such as those drawn by the felon in possession statute between convicted felons and not those that are not. As applied to nonviolent convicted felons, the felon in possession statute does not survive strict scrutiny because it is not narrowly tailored. Thus, it is unconstitutional, and I ask that this court uphold the trial court's dismissal of Mr. Lomax's charge of being a felon in possession of a firearm. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. The state does not need to prove whether someone was violent or not violent. The law or any restriction on the right to bear arms has to survive the strict scrutiny review, regardless of the nature of the prior felony. If the legislature had wanted to draw two distinct classes of violent or nonviolent felons, if they had wanted to amend the law so that it only applied to convicted violent felons, it could have done so simultaneously with proposing Amendment 5 to the voters, or when Senate Bill 656 was passed after Amendment 5 was enacted last fall, which added restrictions on the right to bear arms by criminalizing possession of a firearm with the possession of a felony level controlled substance, and changed the requirements for concealed carry and was an overarching gun bill that affected numerous gun restrictions and laws.
So under that context, if you have, I guess they've changed it about marijuana, but I think there was, if you had an ounce of marijuana, it was a less than an ounce was a misdemeanor, and over an ounce was a felony. I think they changed it to much less than that now.
It's so, in grams. Over 35 grams of marijuana would be a felony. Under 35 grams of marijuana would be a misdemeanor. So possession of a firearm with under 35 grams of marijuana is not, the possession of the firearm is not a crime. The marijuana is still a crime. Possession of marijuana over 35 grams with a firearm would be a crime under the new subsection 11 of the unlawful use of a weapon statute. And at that time when that law was passed, the legislature could have...
So if someone had 36 grams, they wouldn't be able to go hunting and kill Bambi or have a, or go target shooting or anything like that, which is our God-given right under the Second Amendment?
If they had under 35 grams, the possession of the
they
firearm
could do that,
would not
but
be
over that, they can't do that.
If they have over 35 grams of marijuana, then the possession
we
of the firearm
we take their constitutional right away from killing Bambi.
Well, that restriction, like all restrictions on the right to bear arms, would be reviewed by this court under the strict scrutiny review as required by Amendment 5. And I believe that the state could show a compelling interest in that the law was narrowly tailored in that regard as well. However, when the legislature passed Senate Bill 656 that added that law, they left Section 571.070 untouched. And in this case, that law has already been found to pass strict scrutiny in both Merritt and McCoy. I would ask the court to follow the precedent of those cases and find that Section 571.070 passes strict scrutiny and is constitutional. Thank you.
Case will be submitted.